This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Soon after the attack of September 11th, homemade memorials began to appear near the sites of the terrorists' destruction, and it wasn't long before the discussion about a permanent memorial was underway. The same happened in Oklahoma City. Our guest this afternoon is Edward Lindenthal. He's a professor of religion and American culture at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. Over the last several years, Edward Lindenthal has spent time in Oklahoma City thinking about and writing about the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. He's explored the ways Oklahomans and the nation have tried to make sense of a bombing that killed small children in a daycare center and was perpetrated by Americans in Oklahoma City. Professor Lindenthal has written a book about the aftermath of the bombing in Oklahoma City. Its title, The Unfinished Bombing, Oklahoma City in American Memory. Edward Lindenthal is also the author of Sacred Ground, Americans and Their Battlefields, and Preserving Memory, The Struggle to Create America's Holocaust Museum. He also co-edited the book History, Wars, the Enola Gay, and Other Battles to Preserve America's Past. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Edward Lindenthal, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
It's my pleasure.
Why have you titled this book about Oklahoma City, The Unfinished Bombing?
Well, as I was doing my work in Oklahoma City, I became aware of a number of different narratives through which people and the wider culture really struggled to make meaning of the bombing. There was a progressive narrative about the bombing. Yes, it was horrible, but that focused on the possibilities of civic renewal and focused on the heroic saga of rescue and recovery. There was a religious narrative of redemption through by which communities mobilized the religious resources of their traditions to struggle with meaning. But the title of the book really comes from another narrative, a toxic narrative, and all the ways that the bombing is unfinished and continues to inflict itself on the minds and spirits and bodies of so many people. So it felt to me like a very honest title, and in perhaps a more hopeful way, the bombing is unfinished in that people in Oklahoma City continue to use their searing experiences with the bombing, for example, in talking with people in New York City and in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and at the Pentagon. So it remains unfinished in a whole variety of destructive and creative ways.
Well, September 11th certainly also very much unfinished.
Absolutely.
What do you think about the idea of closure? This is a word that gets batted around all the time.
I think it's one of the most obscene words in the English language, and whenever I hear it, it's like nails going over a blackboard. And most of the folks I know in Oklahoma City feel the same way. It's this sort of self-important puff word from the world of psychobabble that people use. I think it shows an incredible disrespect to anyone in any situation that's lost someone, a victim of violence, to talk about closure. I don't even have any idea what the word means. I mean, how in the world could anybody go up to a mother whose child has been blown up in the Murrah Building and say, well, it's 5 years later, have you reached closure? It's part of a much larger and more problematic issue in American life, and that is that I think we are congenitively incapable of understanding, appreciating, ritualizing, dealing with the chronic affliction You know, we immediately jump intensely and shed tears over an event, but then we want it closed. You know, we want people to get over it. We want them to move on. And if they don't, they're ill. They're suffering from post-traumatic stress, as if there is sort of a term limit on grief. We're uncomfortable with any kind of emotional demonstrations of public grieving, as if grief has to be cool and respectable, that there are sort of behavioral protocols to grief as well. We try and systematize what cannot be systematized by talking about the healing process, as if this is a sort of orderly thing that you can manage in different stages. I think these are horrendous terms. I think they do incredible disrespect to the power of human experience, and they are words that I wish we could banish from any discussions about these searingly horrific events.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't think we give that word much thought at all. We use it, like, you know, without any care, without any thought.
Well, that's part of the problem. I mean, we use the word tragedy in the same way. A friend of mine, Michael Barenbaum, the former project director at the Holocaust Museum, wrote a wonderful op-ed in the L.A. Times where he objected to the use of the term tragedy to talk about either Oklahoma City or the events of 9/11. He said there's a huge difference between tragedy and atrocity. But it's atrocity is not a real pleasant word, and so we tend to be more comfortable with the term tragedy.
Mm. I noticed in the book that you're very careful. The word murder appears quite often.
Yeah, it does, and you're a careful reader, because it's I meant that mindfully. I didn't want to use the term when I talked about those people murdered in Oklahoma City. You know, they're not lost. They're not just dead. They didn't die. They were murdered. Their lives were taken in an act of mass murder, and the constant affliction of that term upon people who read the book, I meant mindfully. And I think the same is true of people in 9/11. You know, people didn't just die on the planes. They didn't die in the World Trade Center. They were murdered.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a police officer. I want to talk about a police officer in Oklahoma City by the name of John Avera.
Mm.
Because here is a man who, his story speaks so eloquently about closure being a non-thing, that it just doesn't happen. John Avera was the police officer who handed little Bailey Allman, the baby, to the firefighter Chris Fields in that photograph that we'll never forget.
Right.
And all these years later, he is living very much with the pain and the memory.
Yeah, that's, I think, one of the most moving parts of a whole moving saga for me, of course, being immersed in Oklahoma City for so many years, was telling the story of the creation of that photograph and the impact of that photograph, and having a chance to speak with Erin Ammon, who is a lovely and wonderful woman, and Chris Fields and John Avery gave very kindly of their time to talk with me. And I was struck when I spoke with John and he told me the story of bringing Bailey out of the building, that there was even a sense of guilt still. Now, this is a couple of years since that I've talked with him, but a sense that, well, you know, maybe if I had brought her out differently, or maybe, you know, if this had gone differently, or maybe if we had found her early, almost in a sense kind of blaming himself for her death. And it was so sad and so moving. And when we visited, I sort of gently said, you know, the people who blew up the building are responsible for her death. You were, you know, doing the Lord's work when you brought her out. But it's clear how these things inflict themselves, you know, on people. And John will live with that, I'm sure, you know, for the rest of his life. These are not things that simply go away. I'm convinced that trauma, although this is not a technical use of the term, that one thing trauma means is that people see things they're not supposed to see, and it does something to us. You know, policemen and firemen are not supposed to have to go into to bombed out buildings and pick up broken bodies of children, and we're not supposed to see the kinds of scenes that we see after Oklahoma City and 9/11. And I think I think it diminishes us in some ways, not through any fault of our own, but just through the sort of expansion of horrific representation, as if there's almost no more that the imagination can conjure up. But yes, it's a stunningly powerful story.
Yeah, and he continues to hold on to the clothing, his uniform, and the things that he was wearing on that day.
Well, at least as of the time when we spoke.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that's the case now. I'm sure the people at the Memorial Center could answer that question. But yes, as of a couple of years ago when we spoke, that was the case. This sort of, and a lot of people did this kind of material link to that day. And there were many other people to whom these material links became important. You know, the Mira rubble itself becomes very, very important, both as a commercial commodity and as a sacred relic. So these material links, I mean, on the one hand, they really give a lie to this sort of nonsensical sense of the secularization of consciousness, because these things become such charged relics. And the same is true in New York City. 9/11 has slid easily and immediately into commercial culture, and one visit around the site is enough to convince one of that. But also rubble and perhaps even cremated remains become sacred there as well, although it's a little more problematic because in New York City you have the cremated remains of the perpetrators mixed in with those of the victims.
Hmm. How do we go from relic to commodity?
Well, commodification is in many ways, you know, the sort of master narrative of the culture, and it's not a new narrative. You know, pilgrimage centers in the Middle Ages in Europe were both holy places and centers for commerce that grew up around them. So there's nothing particularly new about this, but there certainly is, particularly with the media exposure to these events. Commodification becomes a way to participate in these events in many ways. You know, you buy a T-shirt, you buy a photograph, you buy a T-shirt with NY Fire Department on it. You know, that you're sort of participating in a way. I guess this came home to me actually most clearly in the commodification of the image of Bailey Ahman, with newspapers and magazines fighting over the rights to publish it, with Aaron and Chris Fields having to unsuccessfully try and control the use of the photograph, you know, on T-shirts and statuaries and phone cards and all kinds of things. It also came home to me in a different project when I was writing Sacred Ground at the 50th at Pearl Harbor. When I was on the shoreside facility, I was working for the National Park Service at the 50th, watching the ceremony, which was carried out at the memorial, and I was on the shoreside facility with other Park Service folks, and we were watching on closed-circuit TV right next to the gift shop. And at the very moment that you would think would be sort of most reverent, the moment in the morning when the attack took place, the gift shop is just besieged by people buying videos and books and postcards and T-shirts and everything you could possibly imagine. And I began to become sort of uneasy and angry about it, and then tried to step back and think about it some. What does this really say? Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that in many ways, and maybe this is letting people off too easily, but it was a kind of venerative consumption. There was this massive need to participate in the event by touching something material from it. And so you take home a model of the Arizona, you take home a set of slides, you take home a T-shirt, you take home some books, so that there will be that material connection to a site. Now, that's one way of thinking about it. Certainly there are crasser motives that are easy to understand. You know, there's greed and the desire to make a quick buck and all of that that can be involved in this stuff too.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me that after 9/11, look what happened to the flag.
Yeah.
And we didn't really do a very good job of of having this discussion then, although people were were throwing punches over this deal, whether or not to fly the flag. And some people were very disturbed by the flag waving, and others thought that was the only right thing to do.
Yeah, and I think more than anything, that says something about the complexity and the power of a national flag and the different functions that it provides. I mean, for some, it was an appropriate expression of pride in the nation's response to this horrific event. For other people, the sort of celebratory notion of flying a flag was inappropriate at a time of deep mourning and grieving. So I think it says something about the volatility of the flag, and one can certainly think about a whole history of the volatile uses of flags in those ways.
Hmm. I want to talk some more about this idea of participating, of taking part, of being involved. And it seems the media very much has been available to participate in.
Yeah.
It, whether it's the discussion or whether it's almost some kind of beyond discussion. It's something more, it's something deeper than discussion. I was struck in the unfinished bombing, in that chapter where you talk about the media response immediately following Oklahoma City, the bombing, and the similarities to our reactions to the attacks last September.
Mm.
The rhetoric, the fears, share with our listeners your thoughts on similarities between our participation in media from Oklahoma City to September 11th.
Sure. I think there's actually still more to be done on the strategies and rhetoric of the media after Oklahoma City and certainly after 9/11. Perhaps the first thing to say about it is that I was struck by how, with the power of media today, to allow people into other people's lives vicariously, and people from all over the world rode into Oklahoma City after the bombing. I mean, the first group of materials that I went through when I began working in Oklahoma City in the archive there in the spring of 97, it was serendipitous, really, that I began at this place. It was unsolicited memorial ideas that poured in from all over the world. And it was clear that people had been touched by what they saw, by looking at people, by listening to their stories, by these sort of moral dramas that were being played out. Now, again, there are all kinds of ways, I think, to read that, from very charitable ones to less charitable ones. You know, on one hand, there's no question in my mind that people's response sparked by the media was a human desire to share with other people in this horrendous moment, that people were genuinely touched and turned to, you know, whatever means they had, whether it was a letter or sending in a memorial idea or planting a tree or sending money or coming to Oklahoma City or, you know, whatever, to say, I'm human, you know, I care, and I want to share that with you. There were people who were fascinated by, in a voyeuristic kind of way, with, you know, these issues of disaster and these sites of disaster. There were people who inappropriately felt a sense of intimacy with those that they came to know vicariously through the media. One mother who lost a child in Oklahoma City was stalked by a stranger. People would come and visit the graves of children that they didn't know. So there was all of that going on. But it said to me something about the power of the media to open these events, and also that what formerly for many people is a kind of private, intimate experience of grief to be shared with a few, you know, family members and some others. And there were certainly people in Oklahoma City who acted like this. But for more, it's culturally acceptable now to sort of show your insides to the wider public and then have people respond to that. Now, the media did not just take advantage of victimized folks. I mean, they did in many sense, but it was more complex than that, because for some people in Oklahoma City, they took consolation in sort of sharing public eulogies of their loved ones through the media, so that they were able to use the media in an interesting way as well. The other thing that I think the media did in Oklahoma City was to create an imagined community of the bereaved throughout the nation. And one of the reasons I think why Oklahoma City struck such an enduring resonant chord is that I think there's a kind of comfort, almost an allure, in through bereavement we understand ourselves as one. I mean, there's almost no other way Americans can understand themselves as one. We are fractured by race and class and gender and ideology and, you know, all kinds of ways. But in bereavement and in Oklahoma City, there was a real sense of a sort of imagined bereaved community. Now, this is both real and not real at the same time. I mean, it doesn't necessarily endure in meaningful kinds of ways, but it's a very powerful kind of image, I think. So I think that the media created that as well. The media also creates problems when, in Oklahoma City, it repeated over and over and over again that the black Muslims in Oklahoma City had claimed responsibility. And each time they would say it, they would say, well, it's only a rumor, so, you know, we must caution listeners. But by repeating this rumor over and over and over again, of course, what people hear is the accusation and not the footnote at the end. They also caused, I think, problems when they repeated, and it's going to be very interesting to see after 9/11 what comes out of this. I think it's going to be horrendous. Over and over in the first few days in Oklahoma City, when there was nothing on television except for bombing-related stuff, nothing, no regular program of any kind, young children sitting alone watching TV, especially during cartoon hours, watched the recycled image of the blown-up Mura building time after time after time after time. And what child psychologists find out years later is that some of these young children that didn't have parents sitting with them, you know, watching the TV, thought that each time they saw this image, a new building was being blown up. And to this day, some of these children still kick the walls of buildings before they go in them to see if they're going to fall down. Now, given how often we saw and still see these horrific images of the World Trade Center, you know, whether it's the first plane in the corner or that incredible shot of the second plane, you know, going right into the World Trade Center, I have heard from people in New York that there are already problems with children showing up from having seen these scenes too much. So I'm sorry for a sort of long-winded response to your question, but it's a really fascinating and very, very important subject, I think, and interested me immensely in doing the book.
Boy, there's so many things to pick up on now on what you just said. Let me go back to the idea of community, and let me just offer an observation from our community. In the days following September 11th, in fact, in the weeks and months following September 11th, in the local newspaper, there were stories of members of our community going to New York City. This also happened after Oklahoma City. This also happened during the Great Flood along the Mississippi River.
Yes.
So it seems that this is not a new phenomenon, that we do think of ourselves as being with others in times of trouble. We want to do that.
Yes, absolutely. And there's no question that happens, and there's a sort of majestically wonderful aspect to that, of a kind of common humanity, and I would never diminish that. I mean, I think that's very, very important. I also think that there's a element of the spectacular to these things, and people sometimes want to be part of a major historical event in some way, and that sort of enduring appeal of spectacle, even horrific spectacle, is in some sense kind of attractive in a way. There's a wonderful book that has influenced me a great deal by J. Glenn Gray called The Warriors, Reflections on Men in Battle. And he was both a combatant in World War II and then a philosophy professor. And one of the most powerful chapters in the book is called The Enduring Appeals of Battle. And he writes about that while our rhetoric of war is, you know, one of horror and sort of moral rhetoric and all of that, that there is, he says, a human delight in destruction that is alluring to people. And I think...
Is it a delight or a fascination?
You could probably use either word. I suspect he would be just as happy with the other. And I think that explains, you know, a part of this. Yeah.
Well, I guess it is that thing in us that we slow down and we'll look at an accident site.
But there's no question that the sense of a larger community was absolutely essential after Oklahoma City and after 9/11, and also very revealing who didn't belong in that community, because when you establish community, you establish insiders and outsiders. And of course, in Oklahoma City, it was much more difficult to deal with the perpetrators than after 9/11, because they were us. They were decorated Gulf War veterans. They were white. They had gone through the traditional male rite of passage in America in the armed forces. Timothy McVeigh, of course, was a decorated Gulf War veteran. So immediately a whole series of distancing mechanisms begin by which we have to convince ourselves that they're not us. They're not like us at all. They're fanatics. They're crazy. They're at the fringes. They're economically dispossessed, so forth and so on. But they can't be like us. There was, you know, horror when it was revealed that McVeigh could be buried, even after his execution, in a military cemetery. And so very quickly in 1997, I believe, a law was passed that President Clinton signed that McVeigh couldn't be buried there, you know, that his sort of toxic physical presence would defile a military cemetery. Motel rooms where they stayed were redone. Towns where they had lived. So, well, you know, he was only here. They were here for a short time. You know, they're not really like us at all. So community both defines itself by who's inside and counts and who's outside. And, of course, in the early days, both in Oklahoma City and beyond, American Muslims were in for a very difficult time.
Hmm. The way people in Oklahoma City talk about the bombing, has it changed over time? How has it changed?
It's a hard question to say generally, and I would never want to speak for people in Oklahoma City. You know, family members and survivors, whom we tend to think of as these monolithic communities, you know, family members believe or survivors think, you know, they're all individuals with a whole cacophony of voices that emerge here. There are still people who have maintained a kind of privacy about their lives after April 19th, 1995 that I always try to respect. There are people who practice all kinds of active grief, including but not limited to, of course, work on the memorial. There are family members and survivors who work as docents at the Oklahoma City National Memorial Center. There are people who take part in the process and work and then have to sort of drop out after a while. I think there are a number of people who have been very helpful to people after 9/11. I've been struck, I think, over the years by the tremendous courage of people that I've come to know there, who have gone through and emerged as people of integrity and power and conscience in ways that, frankly, I can't imagine myself emerging after going through what they've gone through. I've been struck by the lack of cynicism and mean-spiritedness. And some of this, and I don't want to make too much of this, but some of this I attribute to the incredible memorial process that went on there that enfranchised in such important ways the voices of family members and survivors and eventually rescuers, that they practiced in a magnificent way, really, the arts of democracy by coming together in meetings that were searing and agonizing in the early days, where there was a lot of harsh language, where people had to learn to trust one another and work together along with civic volunteers and eventually professionals to work on the memorial. But they all, through the process, transcended their individual vision of what the memorial should be to a sort of corporate vision of memorialization. And this created a really, I think, very healthy kind of community of the bereaved in Oklahoma City that has left in its wake, I think, a really rich legacy of civic involvement.
Edward Lindenthal is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is professor of religion and American culture at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. We're talking with him about Oklahoma City and also about the events of September 11th and their aftermath. Professor Lindenthal is the author of The Unfinished Bombing, Oklahoma City in American Memory. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions are welcome this afternoon. In Champaign-Urbana, the telephone number 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Talk with us, if you would, about the process of the memorial, maybe even going back to that spontaneous memorial that began along the cyclone fence that surrounded the rubble of the Murrah Building.
Sure. Well, that actually, the spontaneous memorials even begin among the rescue and recovery workers very, very early on, and then people began leaving things at the fence site. Eventually, as the crime scene is reduced to just the one block area around the Murrah site, we get these devotional leavings, both spontaneous and planned, around the fence. There's a long history of this kind of devotional leaving at sites of violence, particularly in Hispanic Catholic cultures. And then, of course, it grows throughout the culture, and it's become certainly one of the ways we now memorialize. And it's a fascinating and interesting part of this story, as it has become an interesting and complex story at Columbine and certainly at after 9/11 at all three sites in Shanksville and the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The memorial process itself that was being put together as individuals were sort of leaving their personal devotions at the fence begins really with a conviction among some family members that this is not a memorial that's going to be done for them. They are going to be involved. And briefly, Mayor Ron Norick asked civic leader and attorney Robert Johnson to put together a task force, 350 people, many of whom are families of survivors, are part of this task force. They don't turn to design first, as if it can kind of resolve this issue for them, but to create a mission statement about what this memorial should do. What do they want people to feel and think and experience when they come there? And this becomes a blueprint. And throughout the process, one of the unshakable convictions was that the voices of family members and survivors would be primary. They wouldn't be the only voices, but they would be primary voices. And this was true throughout the whole process. And so the memorial, both the physical memorial and the memorial center, where the museum is, reflects these kinds of sensibilities of family members and survivors. It's a memorial about faces and names and stories. It's the memorial that is both a place of mourning and remembrance, but also a place of protest against the anonymity of mass violence. And I think despite the fact that New York City is a very, very different place and the issues at the World Trade Center site are so breathtakingly complex about the ownership of the land and the multi-use of the space and the vast scale of death and different family and survivor groups that have grown up with their own agendas, even more important than a process like Oklahoma City be implemented, though, of course, it will be different in some ways.
Mm. We have a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. First, let's go to a caller on the toll-free line on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Doctor, it's a great pleasure listening to you talk about this subject. There was talk, I guess there always is talk in national politics or anything that's of a national catastrophe like this, that there might have been a cover-up. And I read somewhere by this author that there was somewhat some complicity by the government officials. Did government officials, did they go along with, could it be said that the government went along with the sympathies of the those survivors and those families, and ignored for one reason or another, that there might have been others, and they didn't go beyond going after just that one individual that was tried for the crime. And I'll hang up.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, you know, even the government's case against Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols talks about others unknown. So certainly in an event like this, there are always going to be questions. I am not one given to conspiracy theories usually. And while my book is not a whodunit, I have read the trial transcripts, and because there were conspiracy theories in Oklahoma City, and because there were a couple of family members that were sympathetic to some of these conspiracy theories, I tried to learn as much as I could about the impact of these. Almost to a person, all the family members and survivors that I know who attended the trials, who testified in the trials, are satisfied that the truth has come out. Not that there aren't unknown parts of the story, but the sort of wild conspiracy theories about government complicity in Oklahoma City, I don't find persuasive, and almost no one I know in Oklahoma City does as well. Now, as far as the memorial, the government really didn't have much to do with this. This was a city project, even though the Muir Building had been a federal building, and the land was given for the memorial. So this was a city-sponsored project. The government is involved now because the Oklahoma City National Memorial is part of the National Park Service. The first site of mass murder, I might add, and I'm not counting battlefields as a site of mass murders. There's something, I think, very different. This is the first site of mass murder that's become part of a constellation of sites of the National Park Service.
Let's talk with another listener, this one on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Am I on?
You are.
Okay. There is something happening that ever since this disaster in New York that has bothered me, and some people have stopped doing it. Celeste does not do it. But we never refer to the bombing of Pearl Harbor as 12/7. I do not think that they should reduce it to a number like 9/11. Whatever they should speak of, they should speak of it as September the 11th. A lot of people have stopped doing it. A lot of news people have stopped doing it. But it is too important a thing to just reduce to a number.
Interesting. Yes, I think I share your sentiment, although I think I probably have the bad habit of still doing that.
Yeah, it's just too important a happening to reduce it to a number. It should be referred to as September the 11th every time it's referred to.
Hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting how those numbers, and I can understand why it bothers you, as if there's a kind of moral implication of not thinking about it enough by reducing it to a simplistic slogan or something.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, that brings up an interesting area of for some thinking about, and that is how we talk about things, you know, and how earlier we talked about how easy it is to use that word closure when it's really an awful thing to. It's really, it doesn't work. It's it's wrong.
Yeah.
Wrong-headed.
Yeah.
Start to finish.
Yeah, words matter a lot here, and it would be a very interesting exercise after 9/11.
September the 11th.
My bad habit continues. After September 11th to gather almost all the words that had been written. I mean, it would be difficult, but it's probably doable. And one wonders how many of them are really enduring words. You know, I read thousands and thousands of words after the Oklahoma City bombing, and it's amazing how few of them are really, really meaningful. But the language is really important. I'm writing now. I'm going back to Oklahoma to do the Oklahoma Humanities annual lecture in just a couple of weeks. And one of the things I'm going to reflect on a little bit is the Ouachita historic site, the famous battle that George Armstrong Custer was involved in when he attacked the village of Southern Cheyenne. And one of the really volatile issues at the site is whether it was a battle or a massacre. And, I mean, it's one word, but whole different worlds of interpretation, you know, open up over which word, you know, you choose. The word sacrifice, for example, and I wrote about this, you may remember, in the book, when President Clinton and Governor Keating used the term sacrifice to talk about the people in the Muir mm-hmm. building, it really grated on me, mm-hmm. and I know grated on some family members as well. President Clinton said that these people gave their lives for their country. They sacrificed for their country. Well, I mean, this is a comforting notion and fits nicely into narratives of recognizable patriotic rhetoric, but it's simply not the case. You know, these people's lives were taken in an act of mass murder. They were not given in a conscious act of sacrifice. Nurse Rebecca Anderson, who died trying to save people, did. On September 11th, we can think about the rescuers who rushed into the Trade Center as having sacrificed their lives. Absolutely. The passengers who brought down United 93 mm-hmm. over Shanksville as having sacrificed themselves. Well, these words become very important and very powerful. I'm intrigued, and I don't know the answer to this. I'm intrigued with our use of the term Ground Zero, which has such apocalyptic resonance from the Trinity site, the testing of the atomic bomb in July of 1945. Now, where that arises in talking about the events of September 11th, I would be intrigued to sort of know the history of that.
Well, what do you think of the word that was used to describe the rubble of the Murrah building, the pile?
Yeah, well, it was used by people working there, so they sort of have the right, I guess,
yeah.
To call it. It never bothered me, and I don't recall that I heard anybody take umbrage, you know, with that term, frankly.
There's been now a great deal of conversation on a memorial in New York City. And the papers, the New York papers, have been carrying lots of columns and lots of articles about that discussion, about that debate.
Yes.
Any thoughts so far about some of the ideas that have been kicked around and how people are talking about how to memorialize what
yeah.
happened on September 11th?
Yeah, I've been trying to follow that, and I was in New York in mid-December to talk with some folks who have been thinking about memorialization and had a chance to be at the site, and then went to Shanksville, Pennsylvania, to join Bob Johnson, who directed the Oklahoma City process, and Philip Thompson, who lost his mother in the bombing, whose remains were in the Murrah building for 5 weeks until the building was imploded. And we spoke at a meeting in Shanksville about memorialization, this small rural community in Pennsylvania. It's a stunningly powerful site. And the intensity of people at the meeting was really quite incredible. So many things are similar and remind me of Oklahoma City. The immediate focus on rebuilding is an act of protest. The turn to design as a kind of resolution. The emergence in New York City more slowly than in Oklahoma City of family members and survivors reminding people about memorial sensibilities and not rebuilding. I mean, if you look at Mayor Giuliani's, former Mayor Giuliani's 180-degree turn from we got to rebuild, we got to build it higher and better, to right before he leaves office, he's talking about it as hallowed ground. Well, I mean, what's changed there? You know, something pretty important has changed there. I, you know, would not ever be arrogant enough to offer people in New York City recommendations what to do or, you know, what kind of design to pick. What we tried to talk about in Shanksville, and I think it's appropriate for New York City, is that the process is even more important than the end result. Who's enfranchised mm-hmm. to talk about this?
Mm-hmm.
Who gets to sit at the table? How do you adjudicate between the differing groups of family members and survivors and their different agendas? If the Murrah building has no human remains 5 weeks after and is not an open grave anymore and is amenable to transformation into a memorial, a historic site, or whatever they wanted to do with it, what about the World Trade Center with cremated remains of thousands of people that to this day remains an open grave? How do you adjudicate between the the competing interests, the overpowering economic interests in that part of New York City, the sense among so many that this is sacred ground and any act of rebuilding will be an act of defilement. This is going to be a very, very difficult process, and frankly, I think that's the way it should be. I think if we can speak easily or memorialize easily these sites of mass violence, then there's something wrong with the way we're doing it. These agonizing, searing sites call for a long and agonizing and searing process, because the memorial process has become an immediate language of engagement with the event itself. I mean, what happens at New York, what happens in Shanksville, what happens at the Pentagon, the constellation of sites of September 11th, will be our culture's first emplaced interpretation of what these events mean to us.
Mm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's my pleasure.
Edward Lindenthal has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His book, The Unfinished Bombing, Oklahoma City in American Memory. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Professor Lindenthal is professor of religion and American culture at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh.